Hey, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. We have done something special this week. We have unlocked our member show. It is an interview with an epidemiologist who answered all my questions about what's going on with coronavirus, how you can catch it, what are his practices at home to keep his family safe. It is interesting, but really important stuff for you to hear. And so we have unlocked that. It will be in your Ring of Fire radio podcast feed, whether you get it from iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. Just look for it. It's a special episode that we've included that should be right behind this one. But for the future, if you want to get this type of content, you got to become a member. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. That's ROFpodcast.com. You can become a member. And it is your support that keeps this show alive. Your support and your support only. So thanks for listening. And check out that special bonus episode. Welcome to Ring of Fire, a radio podcast. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, we're going to talk to journalist Judd Legum about UPS and why workers feel like the shipping giant is failing to take basic measures to protect its workers. We're also going to talk to former federal prosecutor Ankush Kadari. We'll be here to explain how the federal government has enabled the coronavirus scammers to flourish. And, of course, as always, we're going to be talking to Heather Digby Parton from Salon and Hullabaloo, just about, you know, where we are in this sort of crazy era that we are living in, some of the bigger news stories of the day, but to basically broadly analyze all of it. And for members, we have a doctor from New Orleans. He is a New Orleans-based infectious disease physician, Mark Allen Derry. He explains why New Orleans is likely to be the next epicenter internationally for the coronavirus. But he also addresses just about every single question I had about the coronavirus, how you get it, how it's transmitted, what are his biggest fears as an epidemiologist, also where are we in terms of developing tests and vaccines. All of this. And so what we've decided to do, members, it will be attached to their member show. And if you are a free listener, we are going to basically release that interview with Mark Allen Derry as a separate podcast. We will unlock it for non-members just because this is really important information and we wanted you to have that. So here to start off the show is Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, good news for America. It appears that this week was the week that Donald Trump finally became president again. Really, it was a day. I guess it was a Tuesday. Was it Tuesday or was it Wednesday? I can't remember what day when he came out and he decided to be somber, and I it is absolutely bizarre to watch reporters write that, like, wow, Donald Trump really seemed to get it yesterday. I mean, this is just, it is bizarre. It is just all, it is, there is a really sick relationship between the press and the presidency. I mean, it's terrifying to watch this.
Well, you are so right. And in fact, I haven't heard anybody else put it quite that way before, but I think you've really hit on something. It is a sick, sadomasochistic relationship. between the press and the president at this point. I mean, all you have to do is look at his coronavirus rallies that he's been holding. He's been abusing, this is one of the set pieces of his, of the rally, is him abusing a member of the press for asking him a tough, what he considers to be a tough question, which any other president would just be considered would be a normal question. But so there's this moment of this abuse, and the reporters stand there and take it. They sort of look blankly at him while he abuses them. Then they try to talk again. Then somebody else comes up and often will take the microphone away, and he'll say something, "You're a terrible person, you're an awful reporter," whatever. And this kind of this weird, sadistic, you know, thing that would happen with between the president and some, you know, random reporter, this was happening every single day. So then Trump comes out and says something just that people have been saying for weeks now, months really, the experts, and he acts as though he's taking seriously the threat of the coronavirus the months into the crisis. And they all just kind of, they oh, look, he's, you know, his tone has changed. He's giving what people are yearning for, and he's really taking it seriously now. I think it, Jim Acosta from CNN, a guy who has been the object of abuse by this president probably as much as any reporter around, maybe more. In fact, they kicked him out of the White House for a while. He, of all people who has been abused by him, comes out and says, "I think he really gets it. He, you know, it's obvious that he really gets it." Well, that's just insane. And it's, as you say, this is a sick relationship between them now. And it is twisting our ability to clearly see what's going on. And I'm not talking about the political aspect of this where, you know, I mean, look, I loathe and despise Trump. And I anything that makes it more likely that he'll be defeated in November is good on me, except for an epidemic. That's something I actually would appreciate him doing a good job on, and I, right, you know, we could argue the politics down the line. But the idea that anybody would not at this moment be as clear-eyed about what is happening, including the manifest irresponsibility of this White House and the botching of this emergency response, that they are not doing their job. I mean, this is not about trying to appease him or give him a good day or whatever it is they think. I mean, it has never been more important to be as clear as possible about what is going on. And if you're going to do that, you're going to have to portray what's going on with this president and this government, you know, a little bit more realistically than that. He did not get it. He never gets anything. What happened was, and this is the truth, they showed him some charts that showed there were going to be a lot more deaths than he anticipated. But it was another team that showed him some charts that showed that his polling was not, his approval rating,
right,
was not going to continue to go up, and people were absolute, it's like 79% of the public did not like his idea of opening up the country again. So that's what they showed him, was that his reelection prospects were in danger. That's why he switched, and it has nothing to do with how he got it about the danger of the coronavirus. They really need, you know, this ongoing problem with the press. I mean, Sam, you and I have been documenting this for, you know, nearly 20 years now, and it's not getting any better.
No.
I mean, I shouldn't say that. It's a little better, but it's not nearly where it needs to be.
But, you know, I also think that I can't help but think that what we perceive as being a little bit better is really just is sui generis in a way, that it's that what we're looking at is something that it's just something about Trump that makes it look a little bit better or make the press be a little bit better. But there is just a dynamic. And I think that it certainly appears to be that sadomasochistic, like it's a psychological one. But I also think that there must be it's a financial one, that it's like, there is, it must be a certain type of person who wants to be a White House reporter, and their sensitivity to their career prospects must be so intense in such a way that they would, you know, Jim Acosta, I think, you know, says to himself, "I need to be seen as being impartial in some fashion, and I have a reputation of, you know, getting in trouble with Donald Trump, and so, you know, if I go out there and I give him a a compliment. It's going to make it look like I am somebody who just calls balls and strikes, as it were.
Right.
And, you know, that is a problem. That is a real problem, because that has nothing to do with letting the American public know, particularly in a time of crisis, that you cannot trust what is coming out of these briefings. I mean, you just simply cannot. There has been such a vacuum. And so many of the problems that have that we are dealing with are coming out of that vacuum of leadership in the White House. It is stunning. And yeah. I mean, look, I do not like Andrew Cuomo. I do not like his policies, broadly speaking. I think that he probably got a late jump on stuff in New York State. But I think part of that can be attributed to the fact that literally the federal government was saying this is a hoax. And it becomes much harder if you are a governor to do anything if the federal government is saying that. Now, Inslee and Newsom did a much better job. But in part, I think that's because they had probably a slightly more margin of error than you do in New York because of the density of New York City. I mean, I think that's just it's a little bit apples and oranges. But Cuomo, in his capacity, at least, is giving these, you know, making sure that people have information. And to the extent that he has the capacity or the ability to do so, has been, you know, distributing and both, you know, all the governors have to source this stuff, but distributing it in a way that is rational. Like, he takes this seriously. Mm-hmm. Again, he just basically pushed for a cut for Medicaid. And, you know, when we had all this opportunity to raise revenue with pot sales, if he wanted to, didn't do that. So, I, you know, from a policy perspective, but I'm just to put this into relief. Donald Trump is just up there. He's showboating. He doesn't get any of it. He doesn't get any, he doesn't care. He doesn't care. It is just not why he's there. Why he's there is to win an election. And if they tell him that you will get 5 points approval rating if you are willing to, you know, let 500,000 people die, he would not hesitate for a second. Not for a second.
Absolutely.
If he thought the map said that, if he thought the map said 750,000 people have to die, but what you'll be doing is you'll be locking up these key electoral vote states, he'd do it. There's no doubt in my mind. He doesn't care. He does not care. He does not care. He cares about this one thing. And so he'll put it on. He will act. And the fact that reporters do not make that assessment, right? Like, they're not reporting on the truth. They are, you know, it's like they're looking at a Potemkin village and they can see there's nothing behind there. But all they're doing is reporting on what is projected. And that can't possibly be what reporting is. Reporting is supposed to give you a sense of what the reality is in a certain situation.
Well, exactly. And I mean, and that's also a good illustration, I think, or a good image. The idea that they're sort of reporting this surface side of it. And they're even, you know, there's even developed a kind of a certain way of reporting that says, oh, look, and we've got some inside, they've got some sources on the inside, and listen, this is what's really going on inside the White House, and it's usually some story about chaos, and, you know, somebody said something stupid, and Trump's being an idiot, and whatever. But it's almost taken on the kind of a, you know, a drama. It's become sort of an entertainment. It's not real anymore. Even that part isn't real. You know, I mean, I'm not even sure, I don't know why people would do this with these sources, which I assume are real. I don't think that they're not saying this, but there's almost a sense that the more you portray the Trump administration as being wild and chaotic and crazy, that's almost part of the entertainment. It's almost part of the show. When in reality, there's all this other stuff going on. It's exactly what you said. I mean, something much darker and more insidious. The idea that this guy does not care that all these people are dying, and that this is, you know, that he is facing, you know, this is a crisis that even the best of presidents, you know, even FDR would be hard pressed to do it really well and to ensure that everything went as smoothly as humanly possible within the parameters of the crisis itself. But the idea that this guy, who, of course, is terrible. I wrote a piece this week about how, you know, people should have looked a little bit more closely at his, quote, management style before they anointed him a major businessman based upon The Apprentice, and realized that this guy doesn't, he's never managed anything, and his way of even, you know, doing his own business, the family business he called the Trump Organization, was always to come into the office and just field phone calls and you know, kibitz with his buddies and sign checks and do whatever. I mean, he never really planned or did any kind of strategic sort of thinking about anything, ever. I mean, it's just not how he is, and he's even admitted this. So, of course, he would be terrible in a moment of crisis. He would be awful. But it's more than that. I mean, there is a moral vacuum here. There is someone right. who is so intensely focused on his own, you know, his own future, his, you know, himself, that he is simply incapable of dealing with something where people's lives are at stake. I mean, you could see this in the case of a war as well, right? I mean, this could be the same kind of situation where the guy just simply does not care about the human carnage that is being created by this. And the people that he's put around him, this cult-like devotion that he has got now among people in the country and among the people in his administration, this is a very frightening thing. I mean, the idea that you have all these people who have signed on. I mean, it's not like we haven't seen this before, if you know what I mean. I mean, you know, 1932 brings to mind a similar kind of dynamic of a bunch of people following someone who has a deep, you know, void where his, you know, his conscience and soul should be for personal ambition. I mean, this is something that, you know, is a very, very disturbing thing. And here we are, you know. I mean, luckily we're not in a war in a way, because you could see how that could really, you know, turn into something very, very ugly much quicker, although I think this could too, but it's a slightly different dynamic than a war. In any case, the fact that the press is not, I mean, they have only one thing, one job, and that is to get the information out to the public. All of it, everything that it is, tell people, let them know, you know, a devotion to the truth. And this idea that, well, you know, I got to give Trump a good, you know, give him a little something today so that I'll have my access tomorrow, or so nobody will think I'm being unfair. That those rules should have been tossed out 3 years ago. There was absolutely no reason for them to be doing that. And it's disturbing that in the middle of this emergency, they're still doing it.
Yeah, it is pretty shocking, because I think, you know, at the very least, you know, you say they're following this drama that's within the White House. And I think we have definitely learned at this point that is largely irrelevant to what is relevant in the context of a relationship between people and their government. You know, I'm sure there are some White Houses where it's like, this person's been sidelined, and we see a policy implication to it. But the way that he runs this government, it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that he's mad, or that he's, you know, angry about this or angry about that, or this is getting under his skin or that's getting under his skin. That stuff is just not relevant. And there is definitely a quality of everyone within his orbit, whether it's, you know, Republicans in the Senate, let's say, you know, or Mike Pence going out there saying, like, I don't think Donald Trump ever said this was a hoax or like the flu. I mean, really? Really? Rich Lowry wrote something like that. You know, we don't hear much of him these days, but he wrote, like, you know, it's good for Donald Trump to be pushing back on this whole thing. It's like the flu thing. And I just read that and I thought, this is psychotic. Like, this is psychotic. He was up there saying, not only was he up there saying, he had his minions from, you know, Sean Hannity on down the line, attack Fauci to his face on his show. Sean Hannity had Fauci on saying, this is like the flu. And Fauci goes, it really isn't. And Sean Hannity's like, well, it sort of is, though. And I mean, that is amazing to me. It is amazing. You know, you described it as sort of like a Jim Jonestown type of a situation. That's exactly what it feels like. And you also have down the sort of like, you know, cascading off of Trump, various sort of like, you know, dukes and earls and, you know, other and aristocrats, all just measured by how much they are willing to lie and buy the lies. And then as you get down the sort of like the food chain, you know, there's a lot of people who get reinforcement by taking these positions. You know, it reminds me of that movie. I think it was, I don't know, Dr. Death, maybe, by Errol Morris, about the guy who was just a semi-expert in execution technologies in the United States, like gas chambers. And he just got adopted by the neo-Nazi movement and sort of like just became a renowned Holocaust denier, sort of not full on, but appreciated by Holocaust deniers. And he was just some guy who was just like, you know, I've never gotten this much attention before. So I just went with it. And, there's so much of that that's going on. But let's turn from that half of the equation there's some genuine reality here. New York is a disaster zone. The hospitals are like war zones. I am not in the city at the moment, but sirens constantly blaring in New York now. Just that's the only thing you hear is sirens. New York, I think, is unique in some instances because it is so dense. But I also think we're going to see this play out in smaller versions, but with maybe even more tragedy, because the capacity to deal with this stuff is less in smaller cities and in towns and in rural areas. There is simply not the healthcare apparatus that is capable of dealing with, you know, multiple hundreds of cases of this, never mind thousands. And so I think we're on the verge of just seeing some, like, the next, I don't know, 2 to 6 weeks in this country, I think, are going to be really disturbing, depending on where you are. And you know, we were talking before that we got these, you know, this map in the New York Times this week, where we see the implications of states that had a stay-at-home edict, essentially, in areas, and ones that didn't, in terms of how, you know, how, I think this, we're going to see, this is where the coronavirus outbreaks are going to accelerate, in these areas where people are moving around so much. It really is stunning. I don't know what to say.
Well, you called it, actually. We were talking about this a couple weeks ago when you said, you know, there's going to be a correlation between, you know, higher per capita death counts and who people were, what the media that people were consuming, meaning that, you know, places where people were listening to Sean Hannity and were listening to Rush Limbaugh and, you know, believing Donald Trump, by the way. I mean, this is the president himself was leading this charge from the very beginning that, hey, it's not as bad as people were saying. I mean, that's really what his message has been up until now. And even now, he's still soft-selling it, right? I mean, this guy has been kind of saying, hey, look, you know, we got ourselves a little problem here, but we got it well in hand. It's not as big a deal. And always, always implying that the media is lying about what was going on. Always, and sometimes not implying, saying it outright. And so people who listen to him, people who listen to Sean Hannity, people who listen to Laura Ingraham, people who listen to Rush Limbaugh, these people just simply did not take this thing seriously. And as a result, they have been out there. You know, I mean, I have to give credit to, you know, my governor. I live in L.A. My governor, Gavin Newsom, my you know, the mayor of L.A., Eric Garcetti, very early, you know, had been saying, no, this is really bad.
This is
real. Stay home. Do not go out there. This is for real. And people, to a large extent, a lot of people here, and some are stupid, of course, because humans are stupid, and did not follow the rules. But for the most part, they've been pretty good. And as a result, we don't know yet. There's a lot of, you know, Sturm und Drang around the testing protocols here in California, because they had to outsource them to a lot of private labs, and the lab, there's a holdup in the testing. But if you just go by the death rates, which is really the real story, right, of what's going on anywhere, how many people are dying, California has done a fairly good job at flattening the curve so far. I mean, never say never,
right.
But it has
right.
certainly been better than one might have expected in a, you know, huge international city like Los Angeles, where people were flying in from all over the world every day. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people here. So you would have expected it to be better. But the reason that if this happens, that it didn't, is because very early the state took this seriously. Now, to contrast that with people, you know, in that map that you mentioned in New York, in the New York Times, which showed that this vast swath across the South, including Florida, and some little pockets in the rest of the country, you know, where the governors are Trumpers, no other way to put it. There are people like Brian Kemp in Georgia and Ron DeSantis in Florida who were following Donald Trump's lead, basically saying, and in fact, they're even saying that outright, saying, well, you know, I was just waiting for the president to, you know, say
right.
that we needed to do this. I mean, they're, you know, at this point, I think they're kind of looking over their shoulder going, ooh, you know, he's going to have to share some of the blame for this, because, you know, it's looking bad for them. But they waited. And as a result, you know, there is, I think you're absolutely right. These people listening to Donald Trump and his army of, you know, propagandists out there, they didn't take it seriously. And I think you're going to see in those places, and it is going to, you know, New York, of course, is ground zero. It's absolutely a nightmare. And it is the epicenter of this crisis in America. But, of course, this is going to happen elsewhere, and some of these places just do not. I mean, New York is also a medical, you know, a center of, you know,
right.
first world medical expertise, and has these huge hospitals with all this expertise there. And if it can happen there, I don't even want to think about what happens in Omaha.
Exactly.
Or, you know, but it's some, you know, Atlanta. I mean, you know, this is not going to be pretty, and it's really stunning, because it didn't have to be that way. And if we had a different president, I don't think it would have been that way. I really don't. This is one instance where you can see how federal leadership, had it been even just slightly more competent, much less a really competent government, an executive branch that functioned, had that happened, that a lot of this could have been mitigated. Of course, it would still be happening. You know, you could say it's an epidemic. It's a virus. You know, you can't just, you know, pass a law and stop it. But the response would have been very different, I think, even from, you know, potentially other Republicans. Although, you know, there's always a question, would Jeb Bush have been any better than this? I don't even know. But we certainly know that Donald Trump was possibly the worst person on the planet to be in charge of a crisis like this. And I think those chickens are coming home to roost pretty soon in red America. And it'll be very interesting to see how they react to that. You know, they've been so loyal. You know, I don't know. Will they going to blame Dr. Fauci? I mean,
well,
maybe.
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, you know, there was polling that we talked about last week that suggested that Donald Trump was getting good reviews. I have a feeling that's going to change as people start to see what is actually happening. I mean, this week we had Governor Kemp in Georgia say that he didn't realize that asymptomatic people could pass on the virus. I mean, I don't even know how to absorb that information. That I don't even know.
I know.
Is he lying? Is he not lying? I don't know which is worse, frankly.
And
who is believing him? I mean, I would imagine many, many people you know, you and I, we read the news professionally. And so, you know, we saw this stuff coming, and you and I have been doing this long enough that we can like sort of see, we can see stories that are going to grow, not because of the nature of the media, but of the nature of the way it's being written and by whom, and, you know, measures of alarm. And so, but the idea that a governor of a state until this week wouldn't know that you could catch it from asymptomatic people is just, I don't know how to process that. And so I think Donald Trump, I think this is going to catch up with him. It's going to be interesting to see, like, to what extent, you know, how do people react to this stuff when it starts to come to their communities? I guess we won't know for a while. I suspect, based upon, you know, past experience, and there's been research to this. I in college, I wrote about Millenistic cults where they would say, like, the world's going to end on March 15th, and then March 15th comes, and they come up with a reason to be like, oh, well, the reason why it didn't was because, you know, that guy wore blue yesterday. And so the next date is actually, you know, September 12th. Then everybody goes like, it's September 12th. It's happening September 12th. Like, you know, the I think there's a quality of Donald Trump's support that is very much like that. But some people are going to break off. And then, you know, it raises the question as to, and you know, we're heading into phase four, supposedly, of a bailout rescue program. I'm not even sure I would call it a bailout in the same way. I mean, there are some industries that I think over leverage themselves, and to some extent they're getting a bailout, but for other people it's really more like a relief package, right? Because bailout implies that somebody did something wrong and they need to be bailed out, right? Like, yeah,
right,
you need
too big to fail kind of thing.
Exactly. And but in this instance, like, you know, we have as of today, and these are last week's numbers, we're looking at 14 million people who have lost their jobs. And I would imagine that number, as we speak today, it's not been reported. You know, we're talking about, you know, it was reported this week as to what the numbers were as of last Friday, I guess. I wouldn't be surprised if we are, you know, I'm sorry, we're at 10 million. I wouldn't be surprised if we're at 14 million now, actually. It's, you know, the reporting is at 10, but I would imagine we're closer to like 14 million who have actually lost their jobs at this point. And, you know, the first week or two, you can get away with it. Maybe, you know, maybe you can scrape together something for rent, or a landlord will give you a break. But when we start getting into weeks 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 of this crisis, things are going to get really, really nasty. And it's going to be interesting to see who gets the blame here, because it could very well be we're going to blame, I don't know, some marginal members of our society. We're going to blame some minorities where there's already sort of like a pre-existing prejudice towards them. We're going to blame transgender bathrooms. I mean, things are going to get ugly. Things are going to get really ugly. And there's this quality where everybody's looking around trying to, you know, put blame on it. You know, Trump is out there blaming Obama, blaming
everyone.
Cuomo. China. Yeah, China. I mean, it's nuts. It's really nuts.
Well, I mean, we can look at one group who I think are preparing for this. They have sold more guns in the last 2 weeks, I guess, than any time anyone can remember. And here in L.A., they had actually, the sheriff took, you know, a proactive sort of action here and closed all the gun stores under the public health ruling that it was not essential. Well, they got taken to court, of course, by the NRA and other gun nuts. I think they decided not to fight it because it's just, you know, everybody's stretched too thin to even think about that. So they reopened the gun stores. And there is a group of people out there, and if you read the right-wing stuff, now, you know, maybe it's the same old stuff, right? They're always looking for a reason to go buy more guns because that's what they love to do. But, you know, what you say is, you know, so far we've had a pretty cooperative, aside from people just ignoring it and going ahead with their church services and their birthday parties, there hasn't been social unrest in the sense of, you know, people fighting over resources or, you know, looking to blame someone, as you put it. But that could very well be coming down the pike, and you've got a bunch of people who have been spent years preparing themselves mentally for the idea that they had to, quote, defend themselves against somebody within our own society, whether it's, you know, Mexicans or, don't know, hippies or, well, you know, whatever. I mean, they've got there's somebody out there who they're going to have to, you know, hold off with at the point of a gun. And we could very easily be seeing that. And I don't want to think too much about that or even I haven't even been writing about it because I don't want to, you know, sort of
put that into the universe, right?
Yeah, we don't need to, you know, to be thinking that way. But nonetheless, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that this is not, and we don't have the system that they are trying to put in place to be the relief package or the series of relief packages. You know, we have yet to see whether or not they can actually pull this off, and I don't know if they can. I don't know if the infrastructure for that sort of thing is capable of dealing with this.
We don't have too much time here, but that is that, you know, when you look at that stimulus, right, there is plenty of infrastructure to get that money out the door to corporations. I mean, it is all pre-existing. The pipes are already built. They just got to press a button and the money flows through that pipes and they have the way of absorbing it, right? I mean, they can get that money like that. But for everybody else, it does not exist. I mean, when we look around, we talk about things like some form of single payer system or whatever it is. The bottom line is you look around and we are in such a disadvantage to any other industrialized country in the world because not only do we need to deal with a crisis, we do not have the infrastructure, the social infrastructure, right, to deliver this stuff. We don't have a mechanism to get money to people quickly. We don't have a mechanism to provide health insurance to people quickly. You know, if there was, just to get on my hobby horse again for a moment, if there was Medicare for all right now, however you want to construct it, right? I mean, you know, whatever. I don't want to get into to litigate the details about it. But if every single person was already covered and they were not tied to their employer health insurance, half of this crisis would be resolved. And I'm not talking about the coronavirus crisis, although that certainly would have saved lives, I think. And we would have had a more rational mechanism in which to distribute the services and the medical services we needed to. I'm just talking about going forward. We now have 10 to 14 million people who have lost their jobs. And I don't know how many of them are out of health insurance, but I would imagine, you know, pretty close to 2/3 of them at the very least have no health insurance as of, you know, a couple of days ago. Or to the extent that they do, it is, you know, they're paying, you know, they've already spent any type of stimulus they're getting on 1 month's worth of COBRA type of situation. And we're in dire shape, but we gotta wrap this up. I just wanted to say this, Heather. We have on, we're messing with our format a little bit. In part, it's stuff that we had been talking about. It happened a little bit quicker because of, frankly, because of the coronavirus and the social distancing and costs and whatnot. But we are going to unlock our member show this week. I had a conversation with an epidemiologist from New Orleans. Orleans obviously is, considered to be maybe the next sort of epicenter internationally, moving from New York to New Orleans. But He also has worked on all sorts of epidemics, pandemics. He incredibly knowledgeable about both the specifics of the coronavirus and about things like testing and explaining where we are in terms of testing and what the next phase of testing is going to be in terms of antibodies. So I just want to encourage everybody. We have unlocked it. It does not matter if you're a member this week to Ring of Fire Radio. You're going to be able to listen to it because we're just unlock it, and it'll be in people's streams. We may either connect it to this show or other people's streams. But folks got to take this seriously and start contemplating. And, you know, this is something that I think that, you know, you and I, we should maybe touch on next week. There's society is going to be reshaped by this in many, many ways. And like in all of these circumstances, it can go, you know, there are two sort of broad ways this can go. Obviously there's a lot of different gradations and specifics, but there are two basic choices where we can head after this. And I'm not encouraged as of yet as to where we're going to land.
Yep.
But Heather, stay safe. Stay, you know, in solitude to the extent that you can.
I am.
As always, a real pleasure. Thanks for joining
us. Well, thanks for having me, Sam. I appreciate it.
Due to the risk in the post-COVID-19 world, we now, of course, rely more and more on the delivery of our goods. From Instacart workers to UPS delivery services, workers are putting themselves at risk. But are the companies that employ these workers putting their safety first and foremost? Here to explain what the companies have, or rather have not been doing, journalist Judd Legum. So, Judd, you over at Popular Info have been covering, I mean, among other things, but you have really been on for a while now, the beat that's covering how employers are treating their employees. And it's a specific set of employees in many respects. I mean, it's not, you know, we're not talking about, we're talking about people who are considered necessary, right, or key, but they're not. We're not talking about medical workers who are working medical or folks who are necessarily working for the federal government. It's all the people who are helping with cable, helping with working at supermarkets, working, you know, for UPS and delivery services overall. And then we can get into some of the specifics. How would you say those companies are doing, or maybe we can talk about it from the perspective of the employees. How are they doing with this?
Well, I think a lot of them are pretty scared from, you know, talking to them. And I've talked to, I try to talk to as many as I can when I do one of these pieces. I do it a company at a time, and I try to get in touch with a good cross section of folks. But most people are scared. I think, like everyone, it's hard to acquire the protective equipment. You know, if you want to go out and buy a bottle of Purell right now, it's pretty difficult. And I guess these big companies either are unable or unwilling to do what it takes to get these kind of supplies. So a lot of people don't have supplies. They're putting their health and in some respects their lives at risk. And they're either, you know, they were starting off at pretty meager pay. You know, paid hourly in most cases, and then they're either getting nothing additional or they might be getting $2 more per hour. And that's actually good compared to what some people are getting nothing, some people are getting, you know, a $25 gift card. So I think it is a real struggle, especially when you think about the risks that a lot of these folks are putting themselves under.
Yeah, I mean, I'm been struck, you know, by the, you know, the I guess the variance just in terms of like UPS, and let's talk about them because you wrote a piece on them just within the past day or two, I think it was. That some of the guys who deliver packages to UPS, they're showing up. One guy had a mask, one guy had gloves, one guy nothing, and they are I've been just sort of shocked at, A, you know, I had to tell them a week ago, like, you know, cardboard, it stays on cardboard for 24 hours. And they're like, I didn't know that. And I was like, I don't. How do you, that seems to me like that would be the first thing. They would be the first people to know this, right? Like they would be the first people who would be, this is what their bosses would tell them. Here are your potential, you know, dangers. And here's how you protect yourself. And, you know, here you can share this information with customers if you run into them. And they just seem to be completely left in the dark about this. And I was sort of shocked.
Yeah, I think the communication is really severely lacking at UPS. And it's interesting, you talk to the company, and they have a very smooth line about all the things they're doing, they're communicating all the proper procedures, they're providing all the right equipment. But then you go down and talk to the people who are actually on the ground level doing the work, and what they'll say is, oh, yeah, there was a poster that was slapped up somewhere a few days ago, but other than that, I haven't seen anything, and I haven't heard anything, and I haven't seen any of this equipment. Like one of the things that really struck me about UPS was they talked about how they're frequently refilling their automatic hand sanitizers, you know, those ones that you just put your hand under and it kind of shoots the sanitizer into you. And almost without exception, these UPS employees, dozens of UPS employees, they've never even seen one of these automatic hand dispensers. And one of the things they were talking about is that their jobs, especially the drivers, you know, their jobs don't really lend themselves to frequent hand washing. There's no place to wash your hands. And now all the businesses are closed. So the places where they might go into, you know, a McDonald's or something like that to wash their hands, that's not available to them either.
I mean, one would expect, right, that they would have these things in their trucks. And I guess, I mean, on one hand, I can understand, you know, they as individuals have trouble securing this stuff because they're like all individuals, you know, it feels like in the country. But one would expect the buying power of UPS. I mean, they presumably have planes that deliver stuff all around the country, all the world, right? I mean, you would imagine that there's somebody there who could be like, we can get a, you know, a whole, I don't know, plane load of Purell or whatever it is in, I don't know, in the Philippines. And we can fly it up here in, you know, in a day. We'll have it in a day and we'll have it. I mean, they're a logistics company. Right. I mean, and no. So you'd expect that they would have this. What's going on there? I mean, even from a sort of, I mean, even from the most cynical sort of like business perspective, I would think if they could say, hey, we're making all the effort in the world to make sure that your packages arrive to you, you know, as safe, if not safer than when they left the facility when we picked them up.
Yeah, I think that. And I have heard from workers who literally talk about packaging up a lot of these materials, but not having them available to themselves. You know, they're sending them to other people, but they don't have them in their own facility. And I'm not really sure what's going on, but I think with a lot of the companies, UPS and some of the other companies that I've been focusing on, as the economy kind of slows down and slides, I think, pretty clearly into a recession, there are certain companies, and UPS is one of them, the supermarkets are another one of them, Amazon's probably another one of them, that actually are facing unprecedented demand. You know, there it's like the day, you know, it's like the last shipping day before Christmas every single day because so many more people are buying things with packet, you know, they want to get things delivered because they don't want to go out because they're trying to stay home, which is a good thing to do. But it seems to me that the focus is really on how do you satisfy that demand so that we can maximize the revenue we bring in. And I think that's why there's not necessarily a focus of slowing down and not having these places operate if there's not the appropriate protective supplies for the workers. And I think that's why a lot of these companies have fairly restrictive sick leave policies that require either a positive test, good luck getting one of those, or some sort of formal quarantine order in order to get sick leave, because they really don't want people calling out sick unless they're sure that they have COVID-19 because they want people, they need people to keep up with demand. So it's really a matter of what they're prioritizing. And to me, it seems like in a lot of cases, they're prioritizing keeping up with this unprecedented demand.
I mean, it's sort of shocking in a way. I mean, it is, I mean, maybe I'm being naive, and in some respects, it reminds me of, you know, Ring of Fire has a long history of talking to tort lawyers, and they go in and they see corporations that are cutting corners, that are, you know, they've been doing development on a product for years, or they have a pharmaceutical product that they want to sell off label, and maybe they have some information that there's a potential that this could harm a certain percentage of their customer base, and they're just like, there's just too much cash here, and you know, we perceive that as a potential cost of doing business. It may show up, it may not. We may be able to predict how much it is. We may get it off by 20-30%, but nevertheless, we're making just too much cash, and that's job number one right now. We'll deal with the implications later, and those implications are that people can get really sick.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think that there's not a lot of long-term thinking here, and they want to make sure that they cement these customer relationships, because this could last, you know, as everyone knows, a long time. So it's not just that they're making good money for a week. It's if they can establish themselves as reliable, they can make good money for months and months and months, maybe a year or more, until things, you know, slowly return to kind of normal business. So there's a lot at stake in terms of cash, and you know, the workers, I think, are seen as fungible in this situation, and they're rolling the dice with it.
Have you gotten a sense of are there specific sectors, are there specific employers groups of employees who are starting to take some type of labor action? I mean, I know obviously Whole Foods is a big one, and Instacart. What can you tell us about those, to the extent that you've come across any of them?
Yeah, and I haven't reported myself on Instacart, but I do know that they've you know, taken some action, and actually even the threat of action was able to get them some concessions as far as pay and sick leave and things along those lines. Amazon, I think, is and Whole Foods, I think, is a particularly kind of vexing case, because if anyone has the resources to support their workers at this time, it is Amazon. And they really are doing the minimum. They've done, you know, it's interesting because they're one of the ones who are left with the most restrictive sick leave policy. They're still on, you need a positive test, effectively a diagnosis or an order to be quarantined, which most people don't get because people are being told to self-quarantine if they get sick. And I think they've combined that with something that's good in the right context, which is they're increasing pay $2 an hour, and then more significantly for overtime pay, another 50% essentially for overtime pay. But when you combine those two policies, making it very difficult to be paid when you're sick, but also really incentivizing people to show up because they're giving them an opportunity to make significantly more money than they were before, especially with these overtime hours, you know, you're really creating a very dangerous situation where people are going to, you know, maybe just push aside some mild symptoms. And there's one thing we know from this virus is that some people get very seriously sick and end up in the hospital, and they can't breathe, have to be put on a ventilator. Other people have relatively mild symptoms that you can function with. You know, that you barely notice, and you know, that could be a vector to spread that to other people who might be more vulnerable. So it's a not a great situation. It would be much better if these companies created a situation where if people weren't feeling well, they could just stay home and get paid. But I think they're really worried about people, in their view, people taking advantage of that and then not having enough workers. And that's what they're focused on.
Do we have any indication of workers like this being vectors yet? I mean, you know, I've seen a broad, a broad expression of just how likely or possible or how much caution you should have when you're dealing with, say, with packages or with food deliveries or with food itself. Or stuff that you buy, and happen to pick up at a supermarket. Do we have any sense? I mean, is there any, and maybe this might be a good, question to ask before we segue into, the excuses that we're starting to hear from, Donald Trump and the Republicans as to they're dealing with this. And maybe what we're all missing is some type of federal authority coming out and saying, like, look, here are the standards that you need to maintain for packages. Here are is the likelihood that, you know, it is being passed on by, you know, touching a plastic that somebody had packed in an Amazon warehouse where they may have had COVID, you know, something like that. I mean, do you have any sense? Is there anybody that you've come across that has, in the course of your reporting, that has even, like, from an anecdotal perspective of, like, this is where I think I got it from, just like being around other workers or from a package or whatever?
Well, I haven't heard that, but I do know in a lot of the companies that I've covered, Kroger, which is the biggest supermarket chain, they've had a number of people, I think they're up to four or five now, who have tested positive. And definitely the other workers who are in some of those same stores are worried. Amazon has had a fairly significant number of people test positive, particularly in their New York area warehouses. UPS has had people test positive. So I think that, you know, it's definitely something that within these workforces, it's happening. And so you would expect that, you know, it's certainly very possible that especially if you think of someone like a supermarket employee who's really more in close contact with the public, either spreading it to the public or, you know, and this is more of an issue with like an Amazon or a UPS in the warehouses. You know, I've been told by a lot of people that it's really in a lot of these situations impossible to maintain 6 feet of distance between the right person, other people you're working with, just because of the way, I mean, this is not something I've experienced with, but they tell me the way that it's set up, there's just not enough space to do that and to do your job. So I think there's both of those risks. I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone who contracts it necessarily knows now. Now, I mean, maybe right at the beginning when you had sort of the contact tracing and, oh, this person had it and I was near this person. But like we're so far behind beyond that with, you know, close to 200,000 cases. I don't know. I haven't heard from people who know specifically like where they got it.
All right. Lastly, let's just talk about this because this is, you know, you get the sense that this weekend Mitch McConnell mentioned it on Hugh Hewitt's show, and then Donald Trump got asked it and expressed something at his daily TV briefing. And you start to hear this talking point that impeachment in some way distracted Trump from the COVID-19 response. You have a fantastic timeline at Popular Information under, I think the name of the post was Excuses. But just, you know, broadly speaking, I mean, obviously this is, we're getting an indication that the Trump administration now realizes, they see this as a political liability now because they realize for an extended period of time they were just saying, you know, no worries about this. You outlined pretty, I think, decisively that, you know, if he was distracted by impeachment and was prevented from doing this work, part of that might be a function of his, I don't know, dozen or so golf outings, maybe more, and his traveling. And there was a lot of other things going on that he somehow seemed to find time for. But the COVID-19 was sort of late. Broadly speaking, just, you know, give me your take on this and where it's going.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you can look at the time. The only time this is plausible, right, is between the time he was impeached and the time he was acquitted. He was acquitted on February 5th, and really there was a whole month plus there where almost nothing happened. That it isn't even a plausible excuse. But if you just look at that period, you know, he was not solely focused on impeachment. Far from it. He was constantly at his Mar-a-Lago. He golfed. You know, in one point, I think he golfed 12 times in 14 days. The only days off were Christmas and another day that he was holding a campaign rally. He held many campaign rallies, six or seven, during the time between he was impeached and he was acquitted. He went to an economic conference in Switzerland where he totally dismissed the threat of COVID-19. So the idea is that if he just wasn't impeached, he would have been on top of this. It just doesn't. It's almost laughable, and I almost didn't even write this piece because it's so absurd. But I did feel like, well, it seems like this is going to be a thing, so it might be good to get all this down, to kind of have it and refer back to it later when it comes back up. So I kind of bit the bullet and did it. But it's such a ridiculous idea. I mean, the reality is, until probably 2 or 3 days, you know, 2 or 3 days ago, Trump was saying, oh, this is going to be all over by Easter. So
yeah, he was saying eight or nine days from now that this was going to be over. And, you know, somebody must have, you know, been able to, I don't know if it was like, we have internals that show that it's actually good for you. Your numbers are going up. And he's like, okay, well, then I guess it's bad now. And I'll go out and talk about that. But yes, it is laughable that impeachment and somehow impeded him. But there have been funnier things that have turned out more tragic during this administration. And so I'm glad you did that. And folks can check that out. That's one of those timelines that I think would be very helpful for people to pass around widely. Judd Legum, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Judd Legum is the writer behind the newsletter Popular Info. Go to popular.info to sign up. Read his latest article, UPS Not Delivering on Promises, Workers Say. Hey, you may have seen in your social media feeds, or maybe your folks have gotten calls, scammers claiming to make stimulus deposits by emailing them to your bank account information or by contacting you over the phone. These scams are nothing new. But they're getting worse, and here to explain why the DOJ has failed to stop them in their tracks, the former federal prosecutor, Ankush Kadari. So, Ankush, let's go back a little bit. I mean, obviously, you know, I've spent a lot of time actually with these type of like email scams, and certainly the phone scams. In fact, I've been trying. Whenever I get one from like the IRS, supposedly, or about my computer, I try and get them on tape and mess around with them. Give us a sense of just like, it is amazing to me the response that we get from scammers in a situation like this. Like, they're on it immediately.
They are on it immediately. And I mean, it's really startling. I mean, actually, there's some very interesting data that the FTC has put out this week after my piece came out that actually, I think, sort of addresses your question head on. You know, basically, they have started releasing numbers on a daily basis concerning the number of fraud complaints related to coronavirus issues, right? And we can talk about what types of scams those are, but just to give you a sense of the numbers, a little over a week ago, so that's about a quarter into the year, they had under 4,000 complaints related to coronavirus, right? On Tuesday of this week, they reported that in the week between, the number had doubled to 7,800 complaints totaling about $4.8 million in losses reported. On Wednesday, so yesterday, those numbers went up again to 8,400 complaints, $5.9 million. So that's an 8% increase in complaints, 20% in reported losses, over $1 million in a day. And today the numbers went up again to 9,200 complaints, $6.2 million in losses, with sort of a median loss of $600. So they really have descended. And you know, I would have loved to have been wrong about an issue like this, but these numbers are startling even to me, the rate of increase. And I fear that it's not going to slow down. And I think it's going to get worse, owing in large part to the kind of information uncertainty that we're all operating under as a result of kind of the government's handling of this crisis.
Well, you know, there seems to me that both this is an outgrowth of the way that the federal government has handled this crisis, and in many respects, a metaphor, in addition to its own problem. Because we had pre-existing, you know, the way you deal with this, it seems to me, is by having dealt with other problems in the past, so that when you get to an inflection point, when you get into a crisis mode, you have the mechanisms already, or you've already done enough to lay the groundwork to prepare for this. And what your piece makes absolutely clear is there's been none of that. In fact, it's almost been exactly the opposite. Give us a sense of, like, you know, like what the federal government has been doing about scams in general, right? I mean, I presume it's not like somebody wakes up 3 days ago and goes, I'm going to get in the scamming business. I've never done this before, but I could throw something together. That's not what happens, right?
No. I mean, these are surprisingly sophisticated operations. And they disproportionately tend to operate abroad. And, you know, I'll just give you my own experience having dealt with this scam related to an industry called binary options. And exactly what it was is not really that important. It was a giant scam operating largely out of Israel. And it had been around for years, I think billions of dollars in worldwide losses dispersed across the globe. And what we come to find out is that these were highly managed call centers, effectively hundreds of employees with elaborate phone and computer setups, structured daily operations and targets and managerial arrangements. They're not actually these fly-by-night operations. And I think what you see, rather than things springing up per se, are fraudsters adapting to the environment that is available to them, right? So migrating from maybe financial frauds aren't really going to work so well anymore because people have less disposable income. But these sorts of frauds may work, right, where you're capitalizing on people's fear and uncertainty about the coronavirus. And you're exactly right. I mean, there is a gigantic structural problem here. You know, as I mentioned in the piece, the Department of Justice's prosecution of fraud is at an all-time low, according to data maintained by Syracuse University over about 30-plus years, which is a startling thing to consider. And it is largely because this Justice Department, and it's a trend that started in Obama, so I don't want to entirely overstate things, but it's gotten particularly acute because this Justice Department has decided to shift law enforcement resources away from financial fraud to things like immigration enforcement, right, the crackdown there, or things like the opioid crisis. And some of those initiatives may have some merit to them, opioids in particular, but others not so much. And so right now, the activity in this area from the criminal enforcement standpoint is at an all-time low. And, you know, as I mentioned in the piece, there are generally already reasons why these kinds of cases aren't particularly attractive to prosecutors. They're difficult, they're lengthy, time-intensive, hard to build cases, and they don't, you know, kind of get you in the press like, unfortunately, a lot of prosecutors like. So you're exactly right. I mean, I think largely what we're experiencing now is really the result of years-long neglect. And there's no way we would have entirely stamped this out, right, or entirely prevented crimes like this from emerging. But you know, what we're seeing in the FBI data that they released concerning internet crime is a steadily upward trend, right? And I don't think there's any other crime in the country where we sit around and we just see a dramatic upward trend line, and we tolerate it, right? Last year, people reported over $3.5 billion in losses to fraud, the most, again, that had ever been tracked by the FBI in this space. And it's going to be a huge, huge problem that we're going to be dealing with, and one that will be very difficult to turn around, I think, until there's another administration. And, you know, one thing that I think is actually kind of interesting is that aside from the structural problems, I actually think this administration's handling in the particulars of this crisis seem to have actually created the conditions for some particular forms of these scams to emerge. And what I mean by that is, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I wanted you to be more more specific. I mean, it's obviously the conflicting messages, the lack of messages, these are basically, they create the environment for people to step in and say, oh, there's ambiguity here. This is where we can take advantage of people who are in a semi-state of panic, I would imagine, in terms of the victims, and we can give them answers, right? But go ahead, be more specific with how that happened.
That is exactly right. I mean, information uncertainty is a huge driver of those things. But just to get down into the nitty-gritty, I think that we've seen, based on the reports and what the government agencies are putting out, three broad categories of these scams. And the first of which is people peddling fake vaccines and test kits, right? And, you know, there's almost a one-to-one relationship there, right? One, we have a huge, obvious shortage of test kits owing to the administration's handling of this. But with respect to these vaccines, I mean, I think a lot of older people who are probably watching the president at these press conferences talk about these sort of marginal treatment options and, you know, kind of off-label or treatment options that are outside of what the health officials are recommending are probably getting primed to become victims of scams like that, right? When you have the president himself saying, well, you know, maybe there are other treatments available, you know, got to think outside the box, whatever, whatever. And I think, you know, every time I see him say something like that, I sort of cringe. The second category is
so just to be clear, when the president gets up there and says, like, look, there's a lot of stuff that is, you know, you can try out there that could work just because the FDA has been slow to approve. And then I call up someone like my mom and say, hey, you know, I'm selling, you know, orange shoe polish, which has been proven to help. And, you know, of course, it doesn't have FDA, but we're making it available to everybody because the president has, you know, encouraged us. You just go ahead and buy it, as opposed to if the president's up there saying, we have a defined treatment regimen, we're still looking at for stuff, and don't let anybody tell you that there's some type of easy solution to this. I mean, that's the difference, right? I mean, one is just setting the table.
Exactly. And I would not be surprised if some of these particular people are actually just peddling access to anti-malarial drugs, right, which are the sorts of drugs that the president has been getting up and touting, even though there's no systematic evidence that they're actually useful in treating the virus. That's exactly right. And just to continue, the second area where some of this fraud seems to be operating is in offering people access to government funds ahead of the relief checks or the relief funds that people are supposed to be getting through the stimulus bill. And there, too, I mean, to your point, I think that is a result, at least partially, of information uncertainty because, you know, I had to struggle to figure out whether and how I might get any stimulus funds. And I'm sure most people still don't understand what is going on because there has not been a consistent message or a clear message from this administration or its officials about that. And so there, too, it you know, kind of as you think about it, it's probably not that big of a surprise that people would kind of area like that and think, well, maybe I can take advantage of this kind of information deficit. And lastly, I think the third major category we've seen is people posing as charities claiming to help victims of the coronavirus. And, you know, there too, I mean, I think partially that a scam like that could be offset by government efforts by making clear, or well, I guess first having a clear system in place that is managing the fallout from these cases. You know, we may very well need something like a 9/11 responder type fund for health workers who get sick as a result of this. But right now, the president is on TV every day, you know, telling us it's not that bad and, you know, it's concentrated in certain places. And I think a lot of people are probably seeing that and wanting to do something to help out. And I don't think the government is giving us any clear guidance on, you know, what they're doing that might allow us to kind of feel like, you know, the public doesn't need to step in.
Right. So what I mean, so for folks out there, if they wanted to warn their parents, let's say, we'll hold off on that for a moment. But I just want to just focus a little bit more on. So there has been a policy decision not to have to have any type of like in terms of like dedicating resources to this that you say has been growing since the Obama administration, became more acute during the Trump administration. I'm frankly shocked that they're not interested in rooting out financial fraud under the Trump administration. That's me being facetious. And and it's also there is something ingrained in the DNA, if you will, of a ambitious prosecutor where this is not the area you want to be if you're ambitious in terms of moving up the ladder, because it's just simply not a sexy type of arena. With those things understood, like, give us a sense of what kind of scams are out there. You mentioned, trying to sell, supposed malaria drugs. What other scams are out there that if and who are they directed at? I mean, because I think you wrote in the piece that the yield is pretty low, but they are so sophisticated that if I've got 100 people in a room and they're doing, 30 calls, an hour at least, maybe more in some instances, we're going to find that one in 1,000 person who's going to bite, right? Is that basically how it works?
Yeah, correct.
All right. Well, yeah, so I mean, give us a sense of what those scams are.
Well, I think you mean in general or particularly tied to the coronavirus?
Particularly tied to the coronavirus.
I mean, I think the three that I talk about are the biggest ones. There have also been some reports about using some of these overture, like these emails to infect devices with malware, and also some reports of people calling, claiming to be government officials, representatives of the CDC and the like, in order to solicit like personal information, things like your social security number and the like. Things that can be used for sort of standard run-of-the-mill identity theft. And, you know, those two sort of forms of fraud are, again, those are frauds that happen all the time, right? But instead, like right now what we're seeing is, okay, they're adopting a particular kind of peg, which happens to be the coronavirus. So the email with malware may look like it's coming from the World Health Organization. And I say right. that, but actually that is one that I have seen, so it's not something that is hypothetical. The phone calls that, people get maybe, or the emails that maybe people may get may solicit things like, your bank account information or social security number or, personally identifiable information. The point that you raise about the low yield, as I mentioned, is exactly right. And the question about who these scams are targeted at is an interesting one. In my experience, and so far as I can tell, they are indiscriminate in who they target, right? Mm. Meaning just cast as wide net as possible. But what is the sad reality is that the victims are disproportionately elderly. And that's, for several reasons, one of which is some of these folks may sadly be maybe in cognitive decline, or they may be lonely. I mean, that frankly has a lot to do with it, in my observation, that makes them more susceptible to someone calling them and talking to them on the phone and things like that, and kind of developing a rapport with them that makes them think that this person is friendly and on their side. And that sort of social interaction, unfortunately, among, you know, the elderly population is, you know, lower than, you know, we'd like to see. And I really am concerned, given the obvious isolation directives that we're now all under, that that problem could get even worse. And
right.
So one of the things, you know, that I would ask, you know, your listeners and viewers to think about is, you know, if you have elderly people in your lives, maybe they're friends or family or whatever, just be in touch with them regularly throughout this, you know, particularly if you're not in a situation where you can see them. Maybe they're in another city or state or something, or you're in a situation where you can't go to their homes. That sort of regular interaction, I think, you know, among the limited tools available to us in our current moment until, you know, we have an opportunity to maybe get a new administration in place and have more serious changes take place, is among, I think, the sort of limited tools that we have available to us as, among the public to try to mitigate the consequences of these things.
Ankush Kadari, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Ankush Kadari is an attorney and former federal prosecutor who specializes in financial fraud. You can read his piece, How the Federal Government Allowed Coronavirus Scammers to Flourish, over at Slate.com. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire radio podcast. I want to thank all our guests this week for taking the time during this bizarre era we're living in. And if you're listening to the free podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at ROFpodcast.com. This week, we have unlocked the member content for everybody because it's super important, and we want you to hear it. But future weeks, to access that content, you got to become a member. Like I say, you can do so over at ROFpodcast.com. You can follow Ring of Fire Media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And also, check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. You head over to majority.fm. I do a live show every day at noon. You can check it out at majority.fm, and it's later available as a podcast. Also, the AM Quickie. It is about 7 minutes every morning, 8 a.m. Sign up for it for free at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are served. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.
I will light the match this morning so I won't be alone. Watch as she lies silent. For soon that will be gone. Oh, I will stand, arms outstretched, pretend I'm